Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy news for conservatives today. Martinis, if you will. Ian, let's start with the good one. All three of these deal with the Trump administration. Let's start with the good martini. This is courtesy of USA Today. The nation's top prosecutor outlined an expansion of the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration Tuesday to include directing federal prosecutors to bring felony charges against immigrants suspected of making repeated illegal entries to the United States. Undocumented entry cases have been previously charged as misdemeanors. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in his first trip to the U.S.-Mexico border, detailed the changes as an attempt to establish lawfulness in our immigration system. This is a new era, Sessions said. This is the Trump era, the lawlessness, the abdication of the duty to enforce our immigration laws, and the catch-and-release practices of old are over. In a memo to U.S. attorneys across the country, Sessions said prosecutors must consider charging individuals for bringing in and harboring certain aliens, charging undocumented immigrants with a felony if they unlawfully enter or attempt to enter a second time and certain aggravating circumstances are present, when possible charging undocumented immigrants with document fraud and aggravated identity theft, and making prosecution of assault on a federal law enforcement officer a top priority. Of course, you got a lot of liberal groups howling over this, saying it's unfair to immigrants. They never, of course, delineate, Ian, between legal and illegal immigration. But it's amazing how bent out of shape people can get when you actually enforce the law.
Yeah, I'm qualifiedly optimistic about this. Obviously, this is Sessions' issue. This is the issue to which he's devoted at least his entire congressional career. And it's the reason that he's in the Justice Department. The qualification is that a lot of this depends on implementation. If this turns out to be toothless, or if this turns out to be overzealous and you sweep a whole lot of people up who shouldn't be swept up, if this becomes carte blanche for unreasonable or overly aggressive prosecution, then that's an issue. What's important here is that you have the Trump administration coming out boldly and saying, here's what our immigration policy looks like. And the optics of this are extremely important. When we were dealing with the unaccompanied minor crisis at the border, which lasted a lot longer than most people think. Most people remember the summer of 2014, 2015, I forget, as sort of the one moment. But that was a long period of time. What we knew during that period, what we had good documentation of, was that people from as far south as Guatemala and southern Central America were under the impression once you got across the border, the United States was going to let you stay. This was being basically publicized in those countries and incentivizing people to make that extremely dangerous journey. What's significant, even above the policy schemes that Sessions has outlined here, is going to the border and saying, that ends. Tell all your friends, this is not the Obama administration. Things are going to be very, very different. That type of publicizing of a firm, aggressive enforcement stance is going to be just as important, I would wager, as any of the individual policies that have been outlined.
Yeah, certainly implementation is the key. You can promise to do all you want, but how you actually execute it is critical, and that's why they call it the executive branch. All right, on to the bad martini now, and onto the pages of the Washington Post. The FBI obtained a secret order last summer to monitor the communications of an advisor to presidential candidate Donald Trump, part of an investigation into possible links between Russia and the campaign, law enforcement and other U.S. officials said. The FBI and Justice Department obtained the warrant targeting Carter Page's communications after convincing a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court judge that there was probable cause to believe Page was acting as an agent of a foreign power, in this case Russia, according to the officials. This is the clearest evidence so far, says the Post, that the FBI had reason to believe during the 2016 presidential campaign that a Trump campaign advisor was in touch with Russian agents. Such contacts are now at the center of an investigation into whether the campaign coordinated with the Russian government to swing the election in Trump's favor. Here in paragraph 4, it points out Page has not been accused of any crimes, and it's unclear whether the Justice Department might later seek charges against him or others in connection with Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election. So, Ian, this story is a great Rorschach test, because if you don't like Trump, you see all sorts of tweets and posts saying, tick-tock, the clock is ticking, or drip-drip, this is going to be the latest big step into bringing down the whole conspiracy. On the other side, of course, you say, there's your evidence. The government was spying on the Trump campaign, with Carter Page being an assistant to, at that point, the presumptive presidential nominee of the Republican Party. So both sides see this as ammunition in their quiver. How do you read it?
I think that's right. For me, just knowing what I know about this investigation and having written a little bit about it, I think if you're the White House, you're concerned. This is the first, at least if memory serves, this is the first concrete indication we have that the government was actively looking at that it was targeting a member of the Trump team. The FISA court is notoriously solicitous. Certainly grant you this. But it had turned down at least one FISA request from the Obama Justice Department. The FISA court isn't just a rubber stamp. They do want to see some merit in the case brought to them before giving these warrants. So if you are the Trump administration, I think you have to be a little worried that the court did find probable cause to grant the warrant. And of course, we don't know what came of any of that surveillance. But this is the type of thing that seems to tighten the net, at least a little bit politically. Now, there's a fairly easy way to get out from behind all of this, and that's to make everything as public as and transparent as possible, which the president himself can do, given his extraordinary powers to declassify classified information, among which is this FISA warrant and others, and also to, as much as possible, stay out of the way of and as much as possible support the investigation of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. This is something that the White House can really do if it wants to get to the bottom of this and wants to show that it's sort of thinking about this very serious question responsibly. Whether that'll happen, of course, is another story. As far as the question of the Obama administration's role in partisan espionage, one other story that came out along these same lines is that the classified information given to Devin Nunes, the House Intelligence Chairman, who's now recused himself from the committee's investigation, appears, at least according to a number of reporters who've now had access to the documents, appears not to validate his initial claims. I'm much more skeptical of those that reporting than of the reporting on Page, but it's interesting nonetheless, and another twist in this long and contorted saga.
We'll see where it goes from here. Let's move on to the crazy martini now. Ian, I think the happiest guy yesterday afternoon was probably the CEO of United Airlines, because people stopped talking about him. Sean Spicer definitely blew up Twitter. He blew up cable news yesterday in response to a fairly simple question. The question was from a reporter from Fox News Radio, and the premise was, look, Syria and Russia have been really tight here for a long time. They're pretty committed to each other at this point. Why do you think that you can get the Russians to essentially abandon Assad? And this is what we got from Sean Spicer.
I think a couple things. You look, we didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
Then, after he gave his answer, another reporter gave him a chance to clarify about Hitler not using chemical weapons, and this is where it got even worse.
I think when you come to sarin gas, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the he brought him into the to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that the Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
And then later on CNN with Wolf Blitzer.
I was obviously trying to make a point about the heinous acts that Assad had made against his own people last week using chemical weapons and gas. And frankly, I mistakenly used an inappropriate and insensitive reference to the Holocaust, for which, frankly, there is no comparison. And for that, I apologize. It was a mistake to do that.
Ian, Jim and I have talked a few times over the years about Godwin's Law, and the first person to invoke Hitler's name in any debate automatically loses the debate. Once again, appropriate, whatever point you're trying to make, it's probably not good to bring up Hitler. It's certainly not good to make him look like the better of the two options, even if Assad is the other option at this point. Ultimately, he did apologize, which is good. I think people who use this, and I know you want to talk about this as well, that use this as evidence that this is an anti-Semitic administration are overblowing this greatly. What's your major takeaway?
There are two, one about Spicer and one about the reaction to this. I am sympathetic to the idea that being White House press secretary is quite possibly the most difficult and the most unrewarding job in all of Washington, D.C., with the potential exception of Speaker of the House. Being White House press secretary is just an awful job. I acknowledge this. That said, Sean Spicer is just historically bad at this position. It seems like every other day he's sticking his foot in his mouth. And, you know, this was, of course, the latest example and an especially bad one. And of course, there's the additional point, which is if you are going to compare someone to Hitler, especially if you're going to make the comparison that Spicer was attempting, which is that this was that Bashar al-Assad is in some way worse than Hitler, that would probably demand concrete policy action. And that's not a corner that this administration wants to paint itself into, presumably. That said, the reaction to this was outrageous, with everyone leaping on this idea that either Sean Spicer was basically dismissive of the Holocaust, or worse, that this was some sort of dog whistle and he was trying to, you know, erase the identity of German Jewry. And then, of course, you had the pile on from opportunistic groups like the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect, which is sort of a pseudo watchdog that's headed up by the man who spearheaded the New Jersey fight for same-sex marriage. It's not by any stretch of the imagination one of the central Jewish groups in the United States. But of course, they've been opportunistic about anti-Semitism since the beginning of the Trump administration, not much before. They called for Spicer's resignation. Nancy Pelosi jumped on the bandwagon, called for his resignation. I mean, this is just silliness. Everyone knew what Spicer was trying to say. He said it extraordinarily inartfully, but everyone understood the point. But there is, in a certain way, we talked about this yesterday in terms of the United fiasco, there's a need to escalate. I think that need is particularly true of journalists right now with anything involving Donald Trump. Molly Hemingway on Twitter has a little chart of how to rate any gaffe or potential scandal in the Trump years. And there are only two options. It's either 0 or 11. There's nothing there's nothing in between. You know, everything is four alarms, DEFCON 1, et cetera. And it's silly and it's exhausting. And it's the reason that ultimately I think is politically problematic, because it numbs people, it desensitizes people to real scandal. And I think that that's what, in fact, conservatives were saying for a long, long time, is that when, you know, you accuse Mitt Romney of being a sexist pig with his, you know, quote, binders full of women, et cetera, when everyone knew that that wasn't that what they were attacking Mitt Romney for was exactly what they wanted from him, which was to, you know, increase opportunities for women in his administration. Conservatives say, well, you're never going to cut anybody any slack. Let's find a real firebrand. And in a certain respect, that's how you got Trump.
One of many reasons. I'm going to quibble with one thing you said at the beginning. I'm not going to quibble with the fact that I think Sean Spicer has struggled. But, Ian, I've been in Washington for a while now, and I've seen, I think I was counting while you were talking, 10 different press secretaries going back to the Clinton years. He's not the worst. Scott McClellan will always be the worst.
I forgot about Scott McClellan.
Deer in the headlights every single day for years before Bush finally kicked him to the curb.
I'd forgotten about Scott McClellan. See, I had in my mind Carney, who was just enormously petulant, Robert Gibbs, who was nasty, and then the golden years of Dana Perino, Tony Snow.
Yes, so, Tony Snow was the best, no doubt.
When you compare... compare Sean Spicer to those standards of the Bush administration, it's hard not to feel like he's playing in the minor leagues.
Ian, we'll call time there, and we'll reconvene tomorrow. See you then.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.